Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is part 13 of the Wizards of Money series, and it is entitled Bankruptcy Bills Shoot Out at the Social Safety Net. In this, the 13th chapter of Wizards, we're going to take a look at another chapter 13, and a chapter 7, and a chapter 11. These are some of the main ways under federal law to file for bankruptcy. Importantly, we will look at the strong relationship between the non-stop credit offers we find stuffing our mailbox, email, and voicemail every day, the innovative financial wizardry behind such offers, and the rapid rise in personal bankruptcies. We'll examine who does file for bankruptcy and what causes them to go bankrupt. Then we'll look at the new dream bill of the credit card and banking industries called Bankruptcy Bill that looks set to pass into law soon. Bankruptcy Bill is aimed at thwarting people's attempts to be caught in that final, last resort safety net known as the bankruptcy court. To help us understand both the credit offer onslaught and the salient features of Bankruptcy Bill, we'll talk to Margaret Howard, a law professor at Washington and Lee University and visiting scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. After a look at how people get robbed by credit cards and Bankruptcy Bill, we'll look at how a small business can get robbed by a big bank. In the last section of this Wizards Chapter 13 filing, we'll talk to Greg Bates at Common Courage Press about how their money from book sales was robbed by Bank One, a credit deletion service provided to them by the bank even though they're not a customer. But first, let's talk about bankruptcy basics and the invasion of the credit card monsters. So what triggers personal financial ruin? One book that is an excellent source of information for understanding bankruptcy in America is a book called The Fragile Middle Class, Americans in Debt, by Sullivan, Warren and Westbrook. The authors of this book have conducted extensive studies of bankrupt Americans in one of the few comprehensive studies not funded by the credit card industry. Here is some of what they found. First of all, up until the last year of their study period, which was 97-98, Americans that filed for bankruptcy were overwhelmingly from the middle class. So they are above the bottom 20% of income earners, but below the top 20% of income earners. Secondly, about 80% of bankruptcy filers were forced into bankruptcy due to an unforeseen event such as job loss or change, sudden illness or injury, or divorce. The other interesting thing they found is that excessive credit card debt is increasingly a primary force for propelling people into bankruptcy. In the years to come, this is likely to continue as a major driving force, along with a new partner, the wildly popular home equity loan. Bankruptcy law is federal law. When someone files for bankruptcy, they would file under either Chapter 7, whereby many debts are forgiven, but many assets are also foregone. This provides relief from aggressive creditors and enables the debtor or the borrower to wipe the slate clean and start all over again. Under a Chapter 13 filing, what is known as an automatic stay is granted, whereby creditors can't go grabbing at your last bits of income and assets, and the court process will assist in coming up with an agreed-upon repayment plan. Chapter 13 enables a debtor or a borrower to stop creditors or lenders in their tracks while they come up with a more feasible repayment plan so that desired assets, like a home or a car, can remain with the debtor. Filing for personal bankruptcy under both Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 is intended to provide some relief for debtors and a chance for a fresh start. While it comes at some cost to the creditors and or lenders, such as banks and credit card issuers. Over the years, personal bankruptcies have been increasing faster than the population. On May 16, 2002, the American Bankruptcy Institute issued a press release stating that record levels of bankruptcies had been achieved for the year ended March 31, 2002. Over that year, a record 1.5 million American households filed for bankruptcy. Several trends are driving this increase. One is the increasing number and size of gaps in the social safety net, which one might otherwise be caught by on the way to this last resort option. With a high number of people without adequate health insurance coverage, a sudden medical emergency can push an individual or family over the edge and into bankruptcy court. More often, it is unexpected job loss or disability that pushes people over the financial edge. Divorce, especially for women who then care for children by themselves, accompanied by difficulty in collecting child support, is another common trigger. In fact, there is evidence now that suggests that single women head of households make up the largest group using the bankruptcy option. In the absence of comprehensive publicly funded safety nets or public insurance to buffer individuals against these shocks, and with creditors pounding constantly on the door, as drastic as it seems, sometimes bankruptcy provides the only avenue of some relief. Middle class debt loads have increased over the years. The book, The Fragile Middle Class, points out that the amount of debt relative to income that usually triggers a bankruptcy has remained fairly constant over the years. So then why is the number of bankruptcies rising faster than the population? It must be because, on the whole, the middle class debt load relative to income is increasing, meaning that more people are crossing that threshold that can trigger bankruptcy. Several decades ago, on average, people didn't accumulate as much debt as they do today, and so they had more of a personal safety net of their own to weather the storm of any of these common financial ruin triggers, which are, again, job loss or change, sickness or injury, and divorce. But with the increasing debt load households are taking on, these personal safety nets are disappearing right along with the vanishing public safety nets. The increasing debt load has been driven both by increasing credit card debt and by home equity loans in the midst of a strong property market. In addition, all the financial ruin triggers themselves are becoming more frequent, with globalization increasing job insecurity, with higher divorce rates, with ever higher medical costs, and with higher education costs. Now let's talk about the invasion of the credit card industry. We should all beware of the stranger bearing gifts. The sin of usury is well documented in the guidebooks of the popular religions. In the 1980s, these chapters of the good books may as well have been whited out. During the monetary madness of the 80s and simultaneous high interest rates, religious warnings faced the ungodly power known as market discipline. Usury laws of many states that capped interest rates that could be charged to consumers disappeared like magic, and a new religion was born. A full-blown, non-stop nirvana of credit accessibility everywhere you looked. The fact that creditors could now charge huge interest rates meant that credit suddenly became widely available to people who were once considered poor credit risks. Over here you see a billboard saying, "Credit problems, no worries." When you're at home you get a phone call, at the other end is a man with splendid manners, greeting you with, "Ma'am, you're pre-approved for $5,000. And then you look in your mailbox to find it chock full of tens of thousands of ready-made checks and friendly letters saying, "Congratulations, you're pre-approved. Quick, sign here." And so the man with the nice manners and the friendly letters came to take the place of the holes that appeared in the publicly funded safety net. If you couldn't afford your medical bills, put them on a credit card. Lost your job? Never mind. Pay your rent and buy your food on credit. Of course, this is one extreme of how credit is used, particularly by people in desperate circumstances and with no other access to adequate money for the necessities of life. In addition to this is the much more obvious and well-documented role of the credit frenzy in fueling a consumer economy that grew like crazy throughout the 80s and 90s and hasn't stopped yet. This widespread credit feeding frenzy feeds the consumerism that props up the financial markets, and in turn this leads to greater capital accumulation ready to fund ever more access to credit for the poor and middle class, and so the cycle continues. It is a highly leveraged house of cards. Recall that we spoke about the role and dangers of excessive leverage in Wizards Part 11. Recall that we also spoke about the house edge, the amount that the house makes on average in any betting game. The house edge for the credit industry comes from the huge interest rates it charges and can get away with thanks to the market's discipline of the bothersome religious rules in the era of financial deregulation. It is instructive to look at trends in the expansion of consumer credit over the past several decades. Some really good data is available on the Federal Reserve's website, and I'll put a link to that on the Wizards of Money website located at wizardsofmoney.org. But if you want to go looking for it now, go to the Federal Reserve's website at federalreserve.gov, then click on the Research and Data section, go to Statistics, and then go to Set Table G19, which is Consumer Credit. In this data, you will see that the total consumer credit has now grown to $1.7 trillion, and that doesn't even include home mortgages and home equity loans. To give you an idea of how big that is, that's almost 20% of the total US GDP, or gross domestic product. Provision of consumer credit dates back to the early 1900s when catalog stores like Sears, Roebuck and Company enabled consumers to buy goods on credit. The book The Fragile Middle Class points to credit application forms of Sears, Roebuck and Company in 1910 that are sensible credit risk assessment questions such as, quote, how many cows do you milk, end quote. And I'm not sure if that's because the credit card was ultimately secured by the cows or not. During the Great Depression, General Electric, or GE's now monstrous unit GE Capital, the largest of the non-bank financial institutions, was started as a little consumer credit company to help Depression-era folks get access to the necessary appliances for a modern life. In fact, if you look at the Federal Reserve's consumer credit data, you will see that right after the Second World War, non-financial businesses, primarily department stores, were the largest providers of consumer credit by far. Throughout the 1950s through the 1980s, commercial banks took over as the primary suppliers of consumer credit. But by 1989, a new whiz kid emerged on the block, and as of today, the Federal Reserve data shows that it has taken over the banks to become the major vehicle through which consumer credit is now supplied. This vehicle is the handiwork of the bankers and investment bankers themselves. It is also the one that snuck into the big hole left in the crumbling social safety net while nobody was looking. For, in conjunction with the high interest rates permissible today, the new whiz kid invention is quite likely the very thing that has enabled the provision of credit to people who really can't afford it, those people in poverty or very near to it. Generally, these are people who are least able to resist an offer of credit. They are also people who, in a more balanced society, may have basic needs met by publicly funded social safety nets rather than through high interest loans. Key to the profitability of lending to the poor is the fact that they desperately need access to credit. often don't understand the impact of high interest and therefore do not act at all like the much-touted rational market player. The creditor can always win the arbitrage game played against the irrational market player. For example, many credit card targets don't realize that under the attractive minimum monthly repayment plan, a balance of, say, just $2,500 might take more than 30 years to pay off. Just like keno and slot machines in our visit to the casino in Wizards Part 11, nowhere is the house edge larger in the financial markets than in lending to the poor without a usury cap. Trainee investment bankers are taught to think, if it's got an income stream, catch it, tame it, and then securitize it. This new whiz kid on the credit creation block is called the securitized asset. Included in this same family are the mortgage-backed siblings known as Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, and Freddie Mac, who you also may be acquainted with, and who will likely be guests on an upcoming episode of Wizards. To securitize a pool of consumer loans, let's say credit card debt, here's what happens. First, a bank or group of banks and or other credit card issuers decide that they'd like to sell the credit card debts owed to them by their customers. In return, they will get some cash that they can use for some new wizard adventures. Then, an investment banker packages all this debt together in a nice pool of credit card receivables, using what is known as a special purpose vehicle, the thing that became famous during the Enron saga. And then the investment banker does some risk analysis to price the bundled up credit card debt. Then they sell the neat new packages of credit card backed securities for cash in the markets, with the cash proceeds going back to the banks and issuers, less a handsome cut for the crafty investment bankers. The new securities are then traded around the markets according to the whims of Wall Street. This is pretty much what happens with mortgages as well. So whether you're paying off your credit card or your house, you actually never know who you are paying to from one day to the next. You are just a little slice of income in a much bigger security. The implications of pooling such risks across many issuers and many different bases of borrowers are quite profound and provide many appealing features for investors in these securities that are basically bundles of credit card receivables. By putting a vast number of credit card receivables behind a security, risks of default are spread across the pool as a whole, and the cost of default is much easier to estimate. There are bound to be a handful of credit card holders who will end up not paying their bills, but in such a large pool, there will be enough of the ones who keep paying their bills to make up for it. The higher interest rates charged and paid by the larger paying group more than makes up for the defaulters, leaving a handsome profit for the investor in the bundled up credit card security. Thanks to these handsome profits, capital keeps flooding into these securities to fund ever more daily credit card solicitations. Due to this ability to pool risk via securitization, combined with saturation of credit in the middle class and the profits that come from uncapped interest rates, credit solicitations are now flooding into the poorest of homes, the bottom 20% of income earners. People in poverty are less able to resist such access to credit, and due to limited experience with it, often don't understand that the huge interest is a killer. Over the coming years, it is likely that those wishing to file for bankruptcy will increasingly be the poor, in addition to the ever-increasing stream of middle class already filing in. The credit monster extends its tentacles ever further into society and into that sector that just might need bankruptcy protection the most. Just as it does so, the credit card industry has almost nurtured into existence its dream bill, the bill called Bankruptcy Bill. The creditor's dream bill makes access to that one final safety net, known as declaring bankruptcy, all that tougher to get to. The end result of making it harder for individuals to declare bankruptcy is this. Profit margins of credit issuers, banks, and investors in asset-backed securities go up even as their base of credit is still growing. Just when you thought it couldn't possibly get any bigger, the house edge increases. So that we could get to know bankruptcy bill a lot better, I spoke to Margaret Howard, a law professor at Washington and Lee University in Washington, D.C., who is an expert in bankruptcy and commercial law. She is also a visiting scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. I started by asking her about the news of the record level of bankruptcies achieved over the past year.
There was a press release on the ABI website on dated May 16, talking about that the year ended March 31st, recorded the highest number of bankruptcies ever for a calendar year.
Yes.
1.5 million. Why is that? I mean, it's obviously the number of bankruptcies have been increasing steadily. Why the highest now?
It's very hard to say, of course, but there are at least two obvious reasons. One is the impending passage of a change in the bankruptcy law that will make it more difficult to file for individuals. So there are some people who believe that folks who've been thinking about bankruptcy or wondering if that was an option they should take are jumping now rather than waiting to see if the law passes so they can get their filing done before it becomes more difficult to file. Another possibility is a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Bankruptcies will lag sometimes a little bit behind a recession because as jobs are lost, people try to hang on for a while. So it may not be unusual to see a larger number of filings several months after recession has begun.
Another thing I was wondering about in relation to that number is I was reading that book, The Fragile Middle Class, and could you just talk about what the importance of that study and what that study found?
I think that study is important because it shows the fact that bankruptcy is a part of middle class America. We sometimes like to think that bankruptcy is something that affects a different class of folks, those people who are not like us. And one of the things the study shows is that people who file bankruptcy are like the rest of us in a lot of ways. It also shows, I think, that a great many of middle Americans are living very close to the edge. And one interruption in paycheck or one medical bill or a divorce or one of those things that were identified in the study may be enough to put that family over the financial edge.
What about the issue of just credit availability? And, you know, every day, all of us know we receive several solicitations for new credit cards in the mail, pre-approved.
Last year, 5 billion credit card solicitations were mailed. That's amazing. I personally believe
that's enough for everyone in the world, just about.
Yes, it is. And, of course, those are going to a lot of Americans who have no credit history. A lot of those are going to college students.
Mm-hmm.
Because the credit card companies, I think, would find it quite useful to get a card in the hands of someone who will then get in the habit of using their card. Even though they don't have credit right now, they expect to have credit in the future. And so the credit card company is willing to run that risk. And besides, mom and dad almost always bail them out.
Mm-hmm.
If a young person runs into trouble. Now, some of those young people don't have moms and dads who have the capacity to bail them out. Nonetheless, those cards are being sent. And those cards are being sent without regard to credit worthiness criteria.
Now, to what extent, then, is the new bankruptcy bill driven by credit card companies and banks who are pushing credit and obviously wanting to make sure that their product remains quite profitable?
Certainly those institutions, the credit card companies, the banks, the auto lenders generally are the entire impetus behind this bill.
I'd like to move on to those bills now, but I think first of all, a little bit of background on what does a person go through if they file for either Chapter 7 bankruptcy and then talk about Chapter 13 bankruptcy under current law? What is the advantage of someone filing for bankruptcy under current law?
Under Chapter 7, the individual gives up what we know as non-exempt property. Exempt property is that minimum amount that you're supposed to be able to keep that's necessary for decent living, the clothes on your back and some kitchen equipment and pots and pans. And there are various items that fall on that list. And each state has a different list of exempt items, some of them quite obsolete.
What if you have a house?
We have what we know as the homestead exemption in most states, which means you can keep generally a certain value out of a house. But that doesn't mean you get to keep your house. But separate apart from that exempt property, the Chapter 7 debtor gives up everything else and in exchange gets a discharge of virtually all of their debts. And the theory is really quite different in the Chapter 13. In a 13, you keep everything. It doesn't matter whether it's on the list of exemptions or not. You keep all of it. But you have to pay back your creditors under a plan that lasts for either 3 or 5, as long as 5 years. Under current law, it can be as short as 3. It can be no longer than 5. And in that period of time, out of your current income, you pay back as much as you can of what you owe to everybody. And it isn't under Chapter 13 that you can try to keep your house.
How many people actually complete a Chapter 13 bankruptcy debt schedule repayment?
Actually, percentage-wise, fewer than half.
So what do they do? What if you filed for Chapter 13 and you came up with a 3 or 5 year plan, but 3 years later you just couldn't do it? What happens next?
Well, either you convert it to a 7. You can sometimes file another bankruptcy as 7. You can sometimes modify your plan. If you, for example, have had a temporary disruption in your income, you can modify your plan to cut the payments back a little bit and try to continue. There are minimums that you have to pay, however, and you can't cut back so much that you go below those minimums.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the new bankruptcy bill. I'd like to talk about Chapter 7. For Chapter 7 filings, what's going to change for someone who would otherwise file for Chapter 7 under current law? Will it be harder for them to file for Chapter 7, and what do they have to do to file for Chapter 7?
Well, what they would do is the new bill will require a lot more paperwork, essentially, and it will impose a means test.
Mm.
And under that means test, and it's a very complicated test, so I may have to just generalize a bit, but we will compare that debtor's filing, compare that debtor's income to the state median income. And if the debtor has less than that amount, then they've passed the means test. But if they have more than that amount, and they can pay back their creditors at least $100 a month, then they will not be eligible for Chapter 7 filing.
So they may be spending something completely different. I mean, their actual cost of living might be different than the IRS schedule.
Yes, exactly. Mm. It might be. And the IRS schedule does have some difference built in based on part of the country, based on whether you live in a major city or a more rural area. So there are some variations built into the IRS formula. But nonetheless, it does not have a really tailored effect.
In terms of the filing for Chapter 7, it seems like there's a lot of administrative hurdles to be overcome, and that a person filing for Chapter 7 may even have to hire an attorney of their own. Is that correct? So it actually becomes expensive to file for bankruptcy.
Yes, the paperwork that this means test requires will be substantial. It requires an awful lot more financial data, some of which has been treated up until now as confidential, tax returns, etc. So the paperwork burden is substantially increased. The new bill will also expose the debtor's attorney to liability for not checking out the data that the debtor gives to that attorney to use on the bankruptcy schedule. And up until now, and in every other area of law, lawyers are permitted to rely on what they are told on the basis of information and belief. as long as there's no reason to believe there's anything wrong with it, and what you're told is credible, you can rely on it and not expose yourself personally to liability if it turns out to be erroneous information. And the bankruptcy bill is going to change that. That's devastating. And the American Bar Association has come out very strongly against that. There's a possibility that what that will do is frighten attorneys away from representing Chapter 7 debtors. And those who do represent Chapter 7 debtors will be forced to increase their fees in part to cover their liability and in part to cover the increased paperwork expenses of this new law. And I think that it's fair to ask whether those handful of debtors who are genuinely out there, but there are only a handful of debtors who are abusing the system, are worth the impact on the system that this means test would impose.
So what will happen to people? I mean, what will happen to these people that formerly would have filed for Chapter 7 and may have managed to, you know, it takes a long period, and obviously there's a stigma attached to filing for bankruptcy, but after 10 years or so, you know, they're back on their feet.
Right.
Now you're pushing a lot of these people from Chapter 7 into Chapter 13, and as you say, even under Chapter 13 now, most people don't even complete their Chapter 13 plan. What's going to happen to them?
Well, the positive and the negative. The positive is that this bill includes provisions for debtor education. It requires debtor counseling before a bankruptcy is filed. Now, we don't have systems in place right now to provide effective and competent counseling to the numbers of people who will be involved. Nonetheless, if we can get those systems in place and provide education, it may be that people can learn better financial skills. It's also possible that some bankruptcies could be avoided. So there's a positive possibility, at least, to the bill.
Will that education be funded? Where's it going to come from?
Well, that's a very good question.
Is that in the bankruptcy bill?
No.
No,
it's not. Right now, we have Consumer Credit Counseling, which is a wonderful organization that's funded by the credit industry. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people to get some advice, try to get some payment schedules made up, and stay out of bankruptcy. And the credit industry has thought it was a good enough idea that they're footing that bill. I don't know they'll be footing the bill for the whole thing. It very well may be fee-based, and if it's fee-based, that's one more expense. We'll have to see how that plays out.
I mean, is there any problem with the credit industry funding that kind of education, or should it be... Should because obviously there's things that the credit industry just wouldn't tell you because it's in their own advantage not to tell you. Shouldn't that education be funded outside of the credit industry?
Well, I suppose ideally, but who has the interest in doing it?
Yeah, I don't know, but
neither do I.
I mean, it's really a public service, you
yes.
know.
And I think you'd find it very difficult to get substantial public funding for that sort of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Congress is inclined to require it. Congress isn't inclined to pay big money for it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem with this bill. The expenses are going up, and there's no obvious place for the expenses to land. We'll just have to see how that works out.
It's very interesting because the day before... the press release came out about the record level of bankruptcies. There was a little article in the Wall Street Journal on May 15th that because it's talking about general education, financial education of people, and that there's really, you know, there's all this emphasis on the education bill, and what's the most definitely lacking in school education is financial education.
Absolutely.
And so this article is talking about how banks are starting to fill that gap so that banks themselves are providing the education.
Well, let me tell you something. An amendment was proposed to the bankruptcy bill that would have required credit card companies to indicate on the statement how long it would take you to pay back whatever amount you owe on that statement. If you pay... nothing but the minimum payment, make no more charges, but pay only the minimum payment at whatever your interest rate is. And the credit industry defeated that amendment. That was a small little piece of information that might have opened some eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that if you have something like a $5,000 balance, which is not a very large balance these days, at the typical interest rate, and you pay only the minimum payment, and you never charge another dime to that account, it will take you something in the order of 15 enormously long time at minimum payments. That's if you're timely, if you don't get any late fees, etc. These things are amazing. And most people do not know that it's costing them that much on credit cards.
And it's interesting, as other social safety nets collapse, you know, we obviously there's a big issue with funding of medical bills, and that, you know, what the welfare, the decline in welfare benefits and so forth, that those social safety nets that were publicly funded are starting to decline, and yet every day the people that suffer from the collapse of those safety nets are the ones who are receiving credit availability in the mail. So it's almost like that is becoming a substitute for what once was a publicly funded safety net, but with a big interest rate attached to it.
Right, and I think that it's asking a lot of someone who's financially desperate, who may have a child or a spouse in the hospital, for example, needing expensive treatment. It's asking too much for that person to not reach for that credit card offer. If the vast majority of people who do just that have every intention of paying it back as soon mm-hmm. as they can. They believe that they can. They intend to. But sometimes that is the first step in a spiral downward
mm-hmm.
because the medical condition doesn't clear up, or a job interruption is added to it, or a divorce comes along, and the financial crisis is compounded, and the credit card balance does not go away. It grows. It grows very quickly because of those high interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things we ought to wonder about, in this economy, we would believe that as expenses go down for providers of services, their charges to us should go down, right? That's economic theory. If it costs you less to make your item, you can pass it along to the customer.
Right.
Or if your labor expenses go down, you can pass your goods along for less. But look how it works in the credit card market. Look at what has happened to the cost of money these days. As interest rates have been slashed,
right,
it's been a lot less expensive for credit card lenders to obtain the funds that they then lend to us. Have our rates gone down?
No, they haven't.
They haven't.
Can obviously get away with it. I mean, there's several trends in that area that I find interesting that the general public just really doesn't understand. One is the death of usury laws in the 80s when interest rates were going up and states, you know, one by one were getting rid of their usury caps.
Well, you understand why credit card companies are centered in North Dakota so often.
Right.
Because North Dakota doesn't have a usury limit on credit card expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court, in a case 20 years ago now, said that the credit card issuer can charge its cardholders whatever the rate is permitted under the law where the credit card issuer is located.
And the other one that people really don't understand, I think, at all is the issue of securitizations, that because I was looking at the Federal Reserve data last night, and it seems like it was about 89 when they started securitizing credit card debt. And so what you have is a massive amount of capital that's available to supply all this credit that's coming to us in the mail every day, and that has grown, the securitized credit card debt has grown at about almost 20% a year since 1989.
That may begin to explain why credit card issuers would issue cards to people who are essentially not credit worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Securitization is a complicated financial device, and and understanding it is extremely difficult. Nonetheless, I think that begins to explain what looks otherwise very bizarre, why someone would issue a card to a cardholder without good credit. And the answer very well may be that the money available through securitization reduces the risk enough that a credit card can be issued to a person who would be laughed out of a bank if they walked in and sat down across a desk from a loan officer. They would never get a loan, even for a small amount, that way, but they can get a pre-approved credit card any day they want. One of the things that we have learned through the research of an economist at the University of Maryland named Lawrence Ossabell is that the credit card profit margin is huge, and the credit card line of banking is five or so times more profitable than any other line of banking. So credit card companies, there's a lot of competition out there, you understand, but those who can really get a hook in the market are doing very well.
This availability of capital for the provision of credit has taken a step within the past few years, another large step, which is the provision of credit to people at the, not in the middle class, but below the middle class, so at very low income. So you're talking about availability of credit to people in poverty.
I think that the hard news is that the federal government and the Congress are uninterested entirely in helping to put some rationality into this frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
MBNA Bank, which is one of the major credit card issuers, was the single largest contributor to the campaign of George Bush. And, of course, Delaware is a center for a lot of banks and credit card banking, and Senator Biden is a prominent senator from Delaware. And he received a great deal of campaign contribution. Now, I can't say that these individuals respond only to the interests of their contributors. That would be unfair of me. But I also don't believe that they ignore the interests of their contributors. And we certainly know that the credit industry has lobbied hard for the new bankruptcy bill and made huge contributions to members of Congress in the last several years while this bankruptcy bill was being evaluated. So the federal government is not going to put any kind of rationality into this lending frenzy through the credit card industry. I fear the only possibility is for ordinary Americans to say, I have a couple of cards, thank you, I don't need any more.
That was an interview I did with Margaret Howard, a law professor at Washington and Lee University. Now, we've seen how individuals and families can get robbed by banks and other creditors. Now let's see how a small business can get robbed by a bank. On April 2nd, a book distributor for small independent publishers, known as the LPC Group, sent a letter out to its book publisher clients informing them that they were filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy because they had just been robbed by a bank. The letter also told the publishers that the money that was robbed had been due to the publishers for books that were theirs that were sold to a wholesaler. The bank that robbed them is a subsidiary of Bank One, a very large, quite profitable, and quite well-off bank, one of the largest in the country. LPC Group, legally known as Publishers Consortium Inc., is a customer of an American National Bank and Trust Company of Chicago, a subsidiary of Bank One acquired during its merger with First Chicago MBD during the late 1990s. LPC Group had a business loan from American National and also a deposit account. The deposit account was used to hold and then distribute funds from book sales of the small publisher clients. On April 1, some monies came into this account from a book wholesaler and were getting ready to be distributed back to LPC Group's small publisher clients. But, all of a sudden, through the wizardry possessed only by banks, the money disappeared. The bank took it. The money from the small publisher's book sales was taken by the bank with apparently no notice to LPC Group or to the small publishers. One of those small publishers who had their money stolen is Common Courage Press. Following is an interview I did with Greg Bates at Common Courage Press about this strange bank robbery.
If you would just describe what LPC Group is and what your relationship is to them, and then
sure.
How the bankruptcy happened.
Okay. Common Courage Press is a publisher of nonfiction books on the left end of the spectrum, and we do about 10 to 15 books a year. And like almost all small publishers, we use a distributor to get the books into the bookstores and out to the wholesalers and so on, because we're too small to do it directly. You have to be really big to be your own distributor. And so We use LPC Group, which has been around for many years, and before that we were with the predecessor, InBook. And unbeknownst to us, the distributor borrowed some money from the bank, and from a bank in Chicago. The distributor's in Connecticut. And, I mean, that's par for the course. Lots of businesses borrow money from banks and so on. You'd sort of expect that. And, of course, being a publisher, we don't really have any direct ownership of the business or any kind of real connection to the business other than we're a credit, a client. And so they borrowed some money in 1999, and then I
What's the name of the bank? It's a subsidiary of Bank One?
Yeah, subsidiary of Bank One. It's American National Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And they borrowed money somewhere over $3 million. And then the I think they paid a bunch of that down, but the bank got nervous about the future health of the distributor.
Or had the distributor defaulted on the loan?
No, they had not.
Okay. So they were up to date on their loan payments.
Yeah, they were up to date on their loan payments.
Mm-hmm.
There were some minor problems, but it didn't have to do with late payment, apparently, as far as I understand it. The distributor gets paid once a month by a warehouse it hires to manage to actually bill out the books and ship them and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then that payment goes into an account.
So the warehouse is paying LPC Group for books that it's already received, which is basically books from publishers like you. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. The warehouse pays the distributor, and then the distributor takes that payment and cuts it up into 85 pieces according to, you know, how many books it sold for who,
mm-hmm.
and mails it out to the publishers. On April 1st, the payment came into their bank account at American National Bank, the subsidiary of Bank One. But before they could slice it up and send it off to the publishers, the bank seized it. It was just over $1.2 million, of which we have a small sliver because we're, you know, you can imagine this cut into 85 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, it's a critical sliver for us.
So it was sitting in LPC Group's deposit account or checking account.
Yeah, I don't know whether it was a checking account.
And the bank seized it.
And the bank just drained out, yeah.
To repay that because they decided all of a sudden to call in the loan.
Right. So.
Okay.
Right. They gave no notice to the. They gave no notice to the distributor. The distributor suddenly realized, "Wow, we're missing a $1.2 million. What happened?" So there was just absolutely no warning. And of course, as soon as that happened, the distributor couldn't pay any of its bills for a simple reason that, you know, if you don't have any money, you can't pay people anything.
Right.
And so it had to go into bankruptcy, not because it was a. Not because the business was unhealthy, but because the bank took the money.
Unexpectedly, yeah.
Yeah, totally mm-hmm. unexpectedly. So it declared bankruptcy on the 2nd of April, one day after the money was taken, and now it's now waiting for payments to come in from other months' sales. It got paid. The April payment was for, I think, maybe December sales or January sales,
mm-hmm.
and then the so then of course the there's a payment in May that comes in for February and payment in June that comes in for March and so forth. The bank is saying that the $1.2 million, of course, doesn't cover the whole remaining amount of the loan, which is about $2.4 or something. The bank is saying, well, we want the other half of our loan back, so we want more money from the publishers.
What gives them the next
payments that are coming in from the warehouse.
What's the argument that they use to say that they have a greater claim over money, which is basically money due from sales of your books, so that's already been goods exchanged, and you're just accepting payment for those goods? What would make the bank have higher claims over that money? That doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right to me, but as best I can, I can give you their argument. And again, I'm paraphrasing, and the best argument would come directly from them. But as I understand it, they are saying that, I mean, we're essentially using the distributors on consignment. We put the books in their warehouse, and then they offer the books for sale, and when the books are sold, we get paid, and then they get a fee, a commission for having sold the books. And the idea, from our perspective, is the money always, the money in the books belong to the publishers, and the distributor gets only a commission. The idea of the bank is that the money and the books belong to the distributor, even though every contract says the books are on consignment, and the bank knew this ahead of time because it had copies of a lot of the contracts. So the bank is saying that even though it says it's on consignment, the fact of the matter is that you didn't file a note with the government saying, it's called a UCC-1 form, that basically says we're operating on a consignment basis. The bank's claim is that they have a lien on the assets of the distributor, which is pretty much a regular occurrence. When a bank lends you money, they want some kind of collateral.
But their argument is, basically the heart of their argument is that the books belong to LPC Group and not to you, the publishers. Is that right?
And more specifically, that the money coming in from the sale of those books belongs to LPC Group and not the publishers.
Yeah.
And you can see there may be some sort of technical argument there. They're counting on the fact that they're the fifth largest bank in the country, and we don't have anything like the resources that they have.
So let's talk a little bit about the Chapter 11 filing, because I think that's even more surprising, is that that LPC Group is in Chapter 11, and then, you know, that what happens then is, or anyone with claims on LPC Group is in court and fighting it out for what they can. Once the company's in bankruptcy, now you would think in that case, you the publisher clearly have priority over in any claims of money that belong to LPC Group from the sale of books. What's going on there?
Well, the interesting part of it is that other publishers who are no longer clients of LPC Group, but who are owed money from the past, there are what you would call unsecured creditors. They're arguing, they have a claim on, like the bank does, on the assets of the distributor, not the books and the receivables, but you know, the commission that they get paid and so on. But they are claiming, some of those publishers are claiming, that the books are part and parcel of the bankruptcy estate. They're claiming, just like the bank is. One of those companies is Marvel Comics, publishers of Spider-Man. So not only am I getting sued by the bank, but I'm being chased by Spider-Man. It's kind of an interesting
question. Oh, I saw that in the comic and I didn't understand it. Now I understand it.
Right.
On your website.
Right.
Yeah. But do you, the publishers that are still with LPC Group, can you describe what your approach is now? Because you're now facing a situation where the bank wants to take even more proceeds of books sold.
Right.
How are you going to fight this?
Well, we're gathering together in a suit with a lawyer representing all of the publishers, and we're fighting back. We think the bank is wrong for the simple reason that the bank knew ahead of time that we were on consignment.
Right.
And, I mean, there's no way they can argue that they didn't. Even if they didn't have the contracts, they would have done the due diligence to figure out the nature of the business
before they offered the loan.
Lent the money. And furthermore, there were discussions as late as February about just what the nature of the business really was. So they just don't have a leg to stand there. And we think we can win, just based on the fact that we happen to be right.
So is this in bankruptcy court, are you taking this to bankruptcy court, or are you taking this to a different court?
No, we're in bankruptcy court, and we're fighting over the right to maintain hold of our own property and the sales and the money generated from
it. Will that include the money that's already been taken?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Back. And so that's one element. But, you know, we aren't going to win this in the courts because without more help, for the simple reason that the banks, the bank has all kinds of ability to delay things or legal resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're turning to extracurricular activities, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
We're asking people to mail into the bank and so on, and argue that you know, what the bank has done is wrong, because we think one of the things at stake here is the reputation of the bank, and without their if they lose their reputation, they will lose far more than the 2.4 million that they're after. And so we're gradually mounting a campaign of people mailing in postcards with that cartoon that say, you know, it's to stop the mugging and so on, asking the bank to relent, basically.
And where can people go to get information about how to get involved and
well, the
contact information?
Is, either to email me directly, it's at gbates@commoncouragepress.com.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you put the word press in there, commoncouragepress.com. Mm-hmm. Or they can just go to our website for a current update, commoncouragepress.com.
And you also have Ralph Nader involved in this,
correct? His letter is on one of his letters on the website. He wrote both the comptroller, who's so outraged, he wrote the comptroller of the currency,
mm-hmm,
who regulates the banks.
And did he get a response?
Not that I know of yet. But he's also written Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Bank One, to say, hey, this is just bizarre. So hopefully he'll get a response soon, and he's promised to take this up with the media and so on. So, I mean, we think it's going to be a wonderful exchange, and we kind of look forward to what happens next, really.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Good luck, and we'll stay in touch and follow this issue.
After this interview, I spoke with a lawyer named Doug Skalka, who is a lawyer in Connecticut representing the American National Bank and Bank One. He didn't want to be recorded, but he told me the following. First of all, the LPC Group loan from the bank was secured by the assets of LPC Group. The bank had a lien on all assets, including inventory. It seems that the heart of this bizarre case can be summed up as a disagreement over two major disputed issues. First is, what caused LPC Group to be in violation of its loan agreement so that the bank could call it in? I do not know the answer to this, but the more important point for the small publishers is this. The dispute is over what the bank has a lien on. What are the assets of LPC Group? Do they include the proceeds of book sales? The publishers claim that such monies belong to them. After all, they had already incurred all the expenses of publishing and putting the books together for distribution in the first place. Common sense would say that the money belongs to the publishers. Nevertheless, as we already saw with Bankruptcy Bill, common sense is quite often set aside in favour of vested interests when it comes to setting the law of the land under which the markets operate. That's all for the Wizards Chapter 13 filing. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org.